Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is quintessential capitalist American Christmas lore. Originally conceived in 1939 by Robert L. May for a Montgomery Ward's Christmastime coloring book, the timeless song most of us know wasn't written until the late 40s by May's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, which would be sung into history by famous country music star Gene Autry in 1949. Over a decade later, a new version of the story was created for television. The 1964 stop-motion Animagic Productions were created by Tadahito Mochinaga under the auspices of the Rankin and Bass Production Company, and both developed and added to the story. It begins narrated by a talking snowman voiced by Burl Ives. Rudolph is born to Donner, one of the eight reindeer famously named in Clement Clark Moore's 1820s poem A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. His red nose is immediately and cruelly deprecated by his father, who vows to hide it and forces Rudolph to smear mud on it. A year later, Rudolph is at the famous reindeer games, and the fake nose his father fashions for him to wear falls off, exposing his nose and earning the astoundingly unchecked derision of everyone, including the coach, the other young reindeer, and Santa himself. The first character to be nice to him is a young doe, Clarice, who says she loves how his red nose makes him different. When her father breaks the two of them up, though, he wanders off feeling ostracized. Then he meets a wholly new character, a misfit elf named Hermie, who hates making toys and really wants to be a dentist. So they run away together. After a while, they meet Yukon Cornelius, a burly gun-toting prospector who claims to own the land he searches for silver and gold on. After a brush with the Christmas-hating abominable snowman, also later known as the Bumble, they escape on an ice float and drift to the island of Misfit Toys, a kind of purgatory for defective toys Santa hasn't but might deliver. Ruled by the flying, lying king Moonraiser, almost straight out of a C.S. Lewis novel, they're allowed to stay temporarily, but Rudolph leaves his friends in the night, afraid of endangering them with his nose. Cut to the next year, Rudolph is a more grown-up stag who returns to Christmastown only to set back out in search of his parents, who were lost looking for him in the previous year. He goes to the Bumble's cave to rescue them, only to get rescued by Hermie, who defangs the Bumbles with his dentist equipment, and Yukon, who wrestles him off a cliff. When they return to Christmastown, everyone apologizes to the misfits for being jerks and promises to do better, and the night before Christmas, Santa asks Rudolph to guide his sleigh in the blizzard, and the rest, they say, is history. Denise, you asked me to review this movie. What prompted you to do that?
First, I have always been inspired by the piece that you did with a guest on The Old Mole back in 2015, which was the Charlie Brown Christmas. And it was a great assessment of a long, enduring, favorite animation that many of us have probably watched over and over again throughout our lives. And I have to admit, I still watch it a little more knowingly now. And so in a sense, that's kind of what happened to me with Rudolph. I do a little babysitting here and there and found myself watching Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer a few weeks ago. And I thought to myself, this is really terrible. So I have a bit of grief in facing what we're about to do. We dissect Rudolph in a way that illuminates its underside. But what really pushed me to want to review it was the point at which we are told the abominable hates Christmas. And then I remembered the abominable has its teeth removed and becomes part of the Christmas family. And that's where I realized that this sense of the outsider, the difference, the nonconformity of Rudolph and Hermie, Yukon Cornelius and the Bumble isn't exactly a heartwarming tale, that there's deep social and political side to dig up.
Yeah, one parody trailer production company, Honest Trailers, did some work on this, and they make a point that I agree with, that in the end, they very superficially apologize and recognize how they wronged their respective different people from the story, but it's not really that deep. We're supposed to feel like this means something, but it is really awkward if we actually try to connect with it on that level.
Something I find really interesting about Rankin and Bass is the shows particularly Rudolph, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Year Without a Santa Claus, all stop motion. They all build their storyline around crisis, and the crisis being whether or not goods can be delivered, and also the origin tale of Santa Claus, the Burgermeister outlaws toys. But there's a crisis around Christmas that by the end it gets restored. In the case of Rudolph, the story of his nonconformity or his difference does put a wrench in what could probably otherwise be a more easily digestible story. Interestingly, the crisis is often brought on by an impenetrable storm, a blizzard. And in our modern lens, of course, we could make quite a lot out of that particular element.
Yeah, climate crisis is kind of very weirdly resonant in this film, when in a time when they probably did not actually even begin to perceive what we see possibly coming now. But there is a crisis in whether Santa is going to be able to fulfill the duty of taking out all the gifts. And this is 1964, so we're already in the 60s, and we already had 10 years of a post-war boom, at least. It's when things are starting to slow down, or they will be slowing down in the next few years. And there's a crisis of the culture and people's rejection of conformity and of the industrial system. And I think the film is kind of trying to take that up, and its trajectory is ultimately that we need to be able to accommodate difference in order to keep the machine going, because in the end it's about keeping Santa going.
The show makes very clear that there are roles that people play, particularly around gender. We have female elves all in pink. We have Clarice, the young doe of note in Rudolph's life, who loves his nose and actually accepts him, but is relegated to the sidelines and not able to help because Donner is the big guy and he's going to go save Rudolph.
Donner, Rudolph's dad, is just really cruel and abusive to him. And there's this weird selfishness that is vaguely aware of status and in that sense, like a broader society, but is otherwise very concerned with no buck of mine is going to embarrass me.
And Santa Claus is also portrayed as brutal, really, that Donner should be ashamed of himself because he has this child with this red nose. Rudolph has no place. And really what we're working towards is Rudolph has no place until Rudolph is needed. Up until this point, there's still an opportunity for Rudolph and Hermie the dentist to kind of go off and build their own lives. But one reviewer raises this question, if you don't fit into society, then where is your place? I mean, they live at the North Pole. It makes it a little bit hard. There's monsters out there. It's real cold, you know. But there's nowhere for them to go. Then we have the Island of Misfit Toys, where all of these misfit toys live. I can hardly tell that they're misfits. I mean, I don't have a problem with a polka-dotted elephant.
Or the sentry Jack in the Box that's actually a Charlie in the Box. And it is really kind of apparent that they're traumatized or terrorized by this idea of what it means to fit in, that something silly like a name, which has nothing to do with how a thing works, would somehow make it a misfit.
Yeah, it's interesting because the program lays out this after-school special opportunity, fails completely, and actually reinforces the tenets of capitalist production and belonging based on utility. This has been written about far more than I had expected, and I feel like I was a little bit behind the curve on it. So yeah, I've got my grief going, but it's truly frightening. And I hear I'm watching this with this 21-month-old child, and I'm thinking to myself, I hope she doesn't remember any of this.
I think it's important to just return back to this idea that these aren't really Christmas stories, or Christmas, we have to understand, has departed from the Christian tradition in important senses, which they are complaining about all the time, and a lot of the Christmas specials, I think, are engaging this. But these are myths of capitalism made out of commercial contexts. Another very popular Christmas story in America is Miracle on 34th Street, which movie mole Jan Hocken and I reviewed some years ago, is set in a department store where the idea of generosity and altruism is tested against the idea of selling goods in a marketplace. And this story is not really about the question of Jesus and his movement for whatever goodness he talked about. It is about realigning all of these feelings that we have because of that centuries-old tradition around it with the capitalist commercial project. This is a mythology from a commodity universe, not the human universe.
In Miracle on 34th Street and The Year Without a Santa Claus, Rankin and Bass, the crisis is belief in Santa Claus. And in Miracle on 34th Street, it's kind of interesting because the whole Santa Claus thing is getting in the way of business as usual, or the business of Christmas, because it's the Santa Claus who has to actually prove to everyone that he is the real Santa Claus. And in Year Without a Santa Claus, again, there's no belief in Santa Claus. So Santa Claus's goal is to, rather than being this punishing Santa Claus that we see in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, this Santa Claus is going to great lengths to prove that he actually exists, and that, you know, another part of the Christmas crisis, or capitalist crisis, really, is how do we keep this thing going over and over again? And these stories tell us in these different ways why Christmas is important and why it has to happen.
In the context of capitalism as a global system, the myth of Santa's toy shop is not anything that existed more than 100 years ago. It has a strange resonance with the reality of colonial capitalism that was raging through the 20th century until at least the mid-20th century. Many people point to colonial projects that exist to this day. And that it is, I think, channeling an awareness of that is coming through media and the culture, and giving it a very different form to understand how the capitalist system is producing all of this amazing abundance. Of course, there was more manufacturing and such in the U.S. before neoliberalism really kicked into gear, but this economy ran on a system fueled by colonial extraction.
And our good friend Yukon Cornelius is that person in Rudolph who is going about with his pick looking for silver and gold. There's a whole song dedicated to it. Another interesting tidbit is after the original airing of the show in 1964, the reprise of Hermy and Rudolph singing We're a Couple of Misfits was replaced by a song called Fame and Fortune. I think they felt they had to make their own correction there to further entrench it in the bowels of capitalism.
We'll have to return to some of these topics in our extended conversation that we're going to offer you. But that's all the time we have today. I've been Joe Clement, and this is Denise Morris. We've been talking about the 1964 Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Animagic Christmas special and a lot of the intersecting culture and history of the times.
Thank you, Joe.
Hurry, tell him he can take the freeway down.
I'd like to return to the way that Hermes' decision to leave toy making is to become a dentist. And there's something kind of corny and cheesy. It stands out to me as very different kind of work than the toy making that he just isn't into. And it resonates a lot with me to think of this as a distinction between socially valuable and necessary work and the kind of superfluous, if in some way pleasurable, production that capitalist puts us through or expects of us and leaves for us to do.
It's really interesting to me that the scene where Hermie confesses that he wants to be a dentist, this overbearing boss, Elf, he can't believe it. Don't they break into some kind of teasing the whole elf group? Mm-hmm. That being an elf means that you are this one thing. And so that's also an interesting piece of the identity or belonging to a particular group that does only this particular kind of work and has only this particular kind of utility in the society. Mm-hmm. And if you break out of that, it decenters the whole thing. There's then the scene where Hermie's supposed to go to singing practice with all the other elves and doesn't show up because he's back fixing the teeth on a doll. It becomes this madness. It ruins everything. That one voice missing just takes the whole package and disrupts it. There are many opportunities in the show to do something unlike what is ultimately the end product, which is what would that other society look like if Rudolph and Hermie stayed misfits and banded together with other misfits in the symbolic sense that this piece functions. And what if other elves saw that and there became then a workers' revolution?
I think that the idea of racial capitalism should help us look at what this is showing us, because there's all of this talk about elf practice and being a good elf, like that this is what you are, it's what you do, like you said. The story is recognizing that this is starting to not really work like it used to, and trying to come up with possible ways to recuperate that disintegrating energy to make room for the misfits and to let what people do grow, become more flexible. And this is in distinction with the kind of division of roles that has to be there to support Santa's toy shop. Santa's toy shop as an idea of an economy, of a capitalist economy, or at least the front image of that economy.
For Santa and for the lion, which is
Moonraiser,
Santa lives in a castle, and on Island of Misfit Toys, the lion lives also in a castle. So there's these established hierarchies, and Santa hangs out in his jammies, reads the newspaper, and Mrs. Claus feeds him up, and the workers work in the shop, and shop floor boss keeps it all going. It's really weird.
It is. And I mean, I don't think that it has to be some vision of the whole society. It's, I think, commenting on many different kind of narratives and layers of social life that are part of a much bigger universe. It's why we need to return to the other Rankin and Bass movies this next year.
I think so. We'll have to flip a coin for which one.